evening, and thank you very much for clapping before I've said anything. And thank you for your kind introduction, which was a bit over the top, but it was all right. I'm very, very pleased to be here, and I'd like to thank you all for coming. This evening, we're going to be talking about rape, and therefore, I particularly appreciate that you've come, because it's not a happy subject. I see before me an audience with huge expertise in this area. I see lawyers and police officers and prosecutors and professors and the Vice Chancellor, who is an eminent doctor, I believe, victim support people. So for some of you, I don't think there's much I can say that isn't very familiar territory. I just hope that I will manage to make it just a little bit, as it says on your website, it's got to be thought-provoking. So I will try and be a bit thought-provoking. I shall do my best. We'll see. In September 2009, I began work on a review of how rape complainants are dealt with by public authorities. The review was commissioned by the last government, but supported by this one. And indeed, views about rape are strongly held, and there are huge disagreements, but not on party political lines. And that is probably a good thing. When I began the review, the first thing I did was to start collecting press reports, transcripts, and other stories. And one of the first that came my way was a piece on Radio 4 about an 18-year-old boy called Daniel who lives on a housing estate in West London. A woman on his estate had reported to the police that one night Daniel was drunk and repeatedly called at her door saying he wanted a relationship with her. Eventually, the woman's daughter let him in. The woman asserted that she asked Daniel to leave, that he became angry. He pushed her into the bedroom and raped her. In the early hours of the next morning, the police came for Daniel at his home. In his interviews with the police, Daniel said the woman had invited him in and they'd had consensual sex. Daniel was charged. He was remanded to Feltham Young Offenders Institution. He'd never been near a prison before. His mother says he found prison very difficult. His lawyers tried to get him bail, but the court refused, saying he might interfere with witnesses. He carved up his arms and was placed on suicide watch. When the trial came up at Isleworth Crown Court in West London, the jury retired for 1 hour and 20 minutes, and then they returned with a unanimous verdict of not guilty. After that had happened, Daniel became withdrawn and a little bit nervy, and he lost his job at a local hospital. We have no information on the record on what happened to the woman who had complained, but presumably she too was not unscathed. Now, there are several ways of looking at this incident. Some people will say, there you are, the prosecution can't do their job properly, the jury have their heads full of myths about rape and expect to be shown pictures of injuries and hear about violence and resistance to violence. Juries are so ignorant about rape. This is just the result of a biased and failing system, another rape victim who didn't get justice. That's what some will say. Others will say, there you are, just another example of a woman lying about rape. It was probably because her boyfriend came home, found out she'd been up to something, and she needed a story to pacify him. A member of the jury might say, what are we supposed to do then? What is expected of us? He said this, she said that, no one else was there, and the judge said, we have to be convinced beyond reasonable doubt. We did what was right according to what we were told. Daniel's mother will say, it's my son who was the victim and it's not fair. And the woman may well say that she still feels traumatized, very bitter about the way it turned out, and there is no justice in the system. So it's complicated. It brings the criminal justice system to the edge of its competence in a number of ways. And I think it forces us to reflect on what the law can do and cannot do. But before coming back to that, I just want to set out a few points about rape. First of all, what is rape? Well, as with crime generally, that depends. Clearly, rape is forced sex. But when is forced sex unlawful and when is it not? It's not always unlawful everywhere and was not always so. Some of you will know The Marriage of Figaro, which is an opera by Mozart. It's about Susanna, who's a maid, and she's going to marry the manservant, who's called Figaro. And they both work for Count Almaviva. Susanna and Figaro in this opera are very happy and sing a lot of happy arias. Because first of all, they're about to get married. And secondly, their boss, the Count Almaviva, is so progressive that he's given up his right to take Figaro's place on the wedding night and to rape Susanna. In fact, he's given up his right to take the virginity of all the women on his estate. And that was the system 2 centuries ago. So we have a lot of history here to take into account. Until 1991, forced sex within marriage in England and Wales was not a criminal act. Although it did become unlawful in Scotland earlier in 1982. In some countries, rape in marriage is still inconceivable because marriage implies a right for a husband to have sex with his wife, and that's it. So rape is forced sex, but within that description, a very wide range of circumstances will come into the frame. I learnt very early on when doing my review that a police officer's rape caseload can be very varied. Rape is not usually perpetrated by a stranger jumping out of an alleyway on a dark night, although there will be such cases. Most rapes are carried out by someone the victim knows, although knows is often not really the right word. Acquainted with might be better. His name was Tom, and I met him in a bar, as a police officer I know who specializes in rape describes it. Much rape occurs in families. A number of rape cases are what are called historic. The victim has decided to report the case to the police, perhaps many years after it had happened. It's often assumed that if there's a rape, the victim will have injuries to prove it. But actually, having injuries is most unusual. One forensic doctor told me, you have to understand the female vagina is built to withstand a lot. It's also often assumed that rape victims will report the attack straight away. But actually, for many people, it takes quite a while before they feel able to tell anyone, much less someone they don't know who's in an official position. About 8% of recorded rape cases are rape of a man. Knowledge and understanding of male rape is very limited. It's often assumed that it only occurs within the gay community or in prison. Men who have been raped find it very difficult to talk about what's happened to them because of the common view that a man should be able to fight off an attacker. As with most crime, only a small proportion of rape is reported to the authorities. It might be about 11% insofar as we know. So when you hear news that the number of rapes is up, it's probably not a cause for despair. It's probably a good piece of news because it means that victims have got more confidence to go and tell someone they have been raped. And we should not underestimate what it takes to go and tell someone that you've been raped. One rape complainant said, describing her experience of reporting, "There are things we don't talk about. Language you don't use, certainly not with a stranger. Talking about my vagina, my body. I could barely find words for what they wanted and what they needed me to tell them about." Reporting the crime requires a very detailed discussion of intimate and personal issues. There are medical tests that are intrusive even in normal circumstances, when there hasn't been a crime and when there's no emotional distress. You have to give your underwear and your personal clothing to professionals for examination. They will be looking at your private life, and matters will have to be told that you might not want other people to know about. For forensic reasons, you will have to give information on all sexual activity in the 7 days before the assault took place, and for a number of hours, you're not even allowed to go to the toilet. In England and Wales in 2008-09, there were 12,129 rapes of women and 964 rapes of men recorded by the police. A lot of cases in the end don't end up in court because the complainant decides not to proceed, or the prosecution decides the case will not stand a chance of being proved in court. But for those that do go to court, what happens in the judicial system? Well, the system's changed a lot in recent years. In 2003, there was a new Sexual Offences Act, which is regarded, I believe, although the lawyers here might not say that so, which is regarded as quite modern and progressive. And the law says that it's rape when someone intentionally penetrates the vagina, anus, or mouth of another person with his penis. That other person does not consent to the penetration, and the perpetrator does not reasonably believe that the other person consents. The essence of this law is that one person having sex with another when that person has not agreed to it is rape. There's nothing in the law about force having to be used. The absence of consent is the defining factor. The absence of consent can be to one form of penetration, although there has been agreement to another. For example, if there's consent to vaginal intercourse, it doesn't follow that there's consent to anal intercourse. And if anal intercourse without consent follows vaginal intercourse with consent, the law says that's rape. The essence of the legal complexity of rape is that the crime is not the act, but whether the person consented to the act. So the argument is not usually, did this person do that to that person? The argument is, did that person agree? And that presents all involved in the legal process with immense difficulties. And over the last 10 years, strenuous efforts have been made by the system to overcome those difficulties with, I think, I would say, with some success. We now have a system with specialization in dealing with rape at the police stage. Most forces have specially trained officers and some have specialist units. So we have specialist police, we have specialist prosecutors, and we have specialist judges. Only judges who've undergone the training and have got what is called in the business their sex ticket can hear rape cases. Measures have been brought in to reduce the ordeal of the trial for the complainant. There's video recording of the police interview and there can be screens so the complainant cannot be seen by the person who's been accused. There are measures to control the amount of information about the complainant that we brought into the trial by the defense to cast doubt on the truthfulness of the complainant's evidence, to suggest that she's always been a liar and always will be a liar, and how could you possibly believe her? And what's the outcome of these legal processes? Well, the Ministry of Justice put out a research report last November, which was a one-off analysis of all the 2007 rape cases where the trial was completed by the end of 2008. 42% of defendants were found not guilty, and 58% were convicted of an offence, of which 34% were convicted of rape, 17% of another sexual offence, 3% of another violent offence, 3% of another indictable offence, and 1% of a summary offence. So 54% were convicted of rape or another sexual or violent offence. More prosecutions for rape are successful than prosecutions for unlawful wounding or for manslaughter, where the conviction rates are lower. I've gone into that in some detail only because I know that the question of conviction rates is often talked about and is an issue in the debate about rape. That's what I would like to say was a brief, it might not have been that brief, but a very brief summary of some facts that are broadly agreed as representing what we know. Now, I want to move on to reflect a little and try and be, as I was required to be, thought-provoking. Some wider questions about the legal system and the place of rape within it. I've tried just to give some facts, but it is clear, if you look at the press and look at politics, that whenever the topic is discussed, a swirl of views arises. And there are good reasons for that, of course. Rape is about sex, violence, power, intimate relationships between men and women or between men and men, society's attitudes to what is acceptable behavior, who's to blame for non-consensual sexual acts, all set against a background of the history that goes back to Count Almaviva and the culturally accepted rape of all young girls. There is a persistent question about the legal process, which was well put, and I did write this before I knew that she might be looking at me in the eye. One of the most eminent scholars on these matters, Professor Jennifer Temkin, who says, I think in one of her books, in the new millennium, the legal process still fails to provide an adequate response to sexual violation and abuse. Certainly, talking to many victims and their organizations as I did, it's clear that they felt that the criminal justice system, as it's currently designed, does not deliver an adequate response to what happened to them. It does not provide what victims feel they ought to have and how they feel that they should be responded to, considering what's happened to them. You may remember Gabriel Brown, who was on the Radio 5 programme with Kenneth Clark, who said, at the moment, a victim is treated like a piece of evidence in an evidence bag. I also heard very often the complaint that defendants, the suspect, the person in the dock, has his lawyer. Victims don't have their lawyer. Now, everybody here who's... I think everybody here, we're in the law school, aren't we? Law, politics, and sociology. So you all know, poor victim, you haven't understood the system, have you? You're not opposing the defendant. The state is opposing the defendant. You are helping the state by giving your evidence. That's how it is in our system. That, of course, is the answer you will give. I wonder if that answer is good enough. Can there be another way of looking at this? My review had to be done very quickly because it was an afterthought and the government was going to have an election, so there was no time to spread it out. But I found the time to have a quick look at this, and I discovered that in Ireland and in France, victims can be represented by a lawyer for parts of the proceedings. So one thought I might leave with you is there a place for that in our system in some way? Maybe another answer is to take more seriously the state's obligations towards victims of violence and reflect on what that might entail. I've long held the view that we should regard crimes of violence in the same way as we regard human rights violations. Acts that call for redress from the state. I was fortunate that the distinguished legal scholar Leora Lazarus from Oxford prepared a paper for my review, which appears in appendix, setting out the state's positive obligations to victims of violent crime, and in particular, victims of rape. And rape is very particular. My study left me with the conviction that rape strikes at the bodily integrity and sense of identity and self-respect of a victim in a unique way. And my thoughts on obligations to victims were clarified to a certain extent by my visits to sexual assault referral centres and my meetings with independent sexual violence advisers. Sexual assault referral centres, for those of you who don't know, are places where people can go and report. You used to have to go to the police station and be examined in a rather dirty room in the police station in not very nice surroundings with a doctor who was called in, who was usually a man. But in the last few years, the government has set up a proper medical environment, a centre that is not part of a police station, which is run by medical professionals, where you can report, where samples are taken, where counselling can be arranged, where urgent medical attention can be arranged, and where, if you say you don't want it to go to the police, the samples can be frozen in case at a later date you change your mind. I visited a number of these places, and everything about them says we respect you, what's happened to you is something we care about. These centres are necessary to get a proper criminal investigation, but they also symbolise our respect for the people who've been harmed, and our acceptance that when people are assaulted and violated, it's our duty to help to heal that violation. The other element that is very helpful in giving victims back their self-respect are the independent sexual violence advisors who support them, look after them, take them through the process, explain it all, organise things that might need organising, changing the locks on their door, for instance, because they are frightened that someone can get in. They're also symbolic of a supportive community. And I did recommend in my review that every victim who wanted one should have an independent sexual violence advisor. That was one of my 23 recommendations. 21 of them were accepted by this government. The government response was very supportive. And just one little quote, which I liked. They said, "We agree. Society has a positive responsibility to help and to protect aside from the operation of the criminal law." I think that is a helpful acceptance that victims are helped because they're victims, not so that you can charge somebody, get it to court, and get a conviction, desirable though all that is. Certainly not to meet someone's performance targets, but because rape is a grave harm and we have an obligation to help repair that harm. A rape victim should never be a piece of evidence in an evidence bag. And in its response, the government made a strong commitment to victims. They have promised that sexual assault referral centres will continue to be rolled out. They've announced 86 more independent sexual violence advisors. They've announced much more support for rape crisis. So that is all good. I did mention that there was a lot of ill-informed talk about conviction rates, and my recommendations there were accepted, and there are there's statistical work going on to come out to produce a better way of knowing what are the outcomes and how they compare with the outcomes for other violent crimes. There are always stories in the press about false allegations. You would think there were hundreds of them because they're always reported. I don't think there are hundreds of them, but we don't know. And the government has now commissioned a research project to see how many allegations of rape can be established to be false, what is a false allegation, and how they compare to false allegations within other crimes. I must say I found it very worrying to see how many people were prosecuted and given very heavy sentences for making false allegations. And I very much welcome the initiative from the CPS to look again at charging when there's a question of false allegations. The government accepted the view that prevention is very important, and they also agreed that messages should not go out, which could be read as saying to women, don't go out in a short skirt and don't drink too much. So that's all very welcome. To conclude, I hope I've managed to get across just the thought that rape does not lend itself to easy answers. Politicians discover that very quickly. The coalition government came to power with a commitment from both the coalition partners to give anonymity to those accused of rape. Then they started looking at it and discovered that the evidence to support or not to support such a move did not exist. And they encountered a lot of opposition, much from politicians on their own side. And to their credit, they looked at what it would entail and abandoned it. But I certainly saw no harm in them looking at it, and it was very educational for them. Undoubtedly, people accused of rape who are not convicted do get a lot of very bad publicity. But I'm sure the answer is not to give anonymity to defendants. Rape highlights a difficult question about what is justice and where should the balance lie. I hope I could persuade you that justice cannot be reduced to a simple definition such as, I've got justice if you who harmed me got punished. There is more to it than that. The police officers and prosecutors who do their jobs well are doing justice in a very broad sense, not just because they're working in the justice system, but by the way they treat the witnesses, the way they recognize the victim first as a human being who's been harmed, whether or not the case will eventually get to court. Justice is also about equality and equal access. It's not only for the articulate and the respectable and the people who will be good witnesses in court, the people who are felt to be more deserving. I was at a conference in the Northeast, and the Northumbria police told us about a case they'd just dealt with. They had used the most advanced forensic techniques to secure the conviction of a care worker who'd raped a middle-aged woman with learning difficulties in his care home. To bring this case was very expensive. It was very time-consuming. And anyone in that police hierarchy might have said, I don't think we can afford this. She's probably making it up anyway. We'll never get a conviction. But they went ahead with it. The outcome was positive. The forensic evidence was so good that he pleaded guilty and he was sentenced to some years in prison. So finally, perhaps, because it seems to be expected of me, a word about the Justice Secretary, Kenneth Clark, and his proposal that defendants who plead guilty at the very beginning of the process should be entitled to a 50% reduction in the sentence they would have received if they had not pleaded guilty. Now, if we genuinely accept that justice is more than the conviction and punishment of a perpetrator, if we accept that the way the victim is treated is important, if we agree that helping the victim to recover is part of a just outcome, then an idea that saves the victim the trauma of the trial, an idea that makes it clear beyond any doubt that the victim was telling the truth, is at least worth a hearing. It's worth some cool debate, some reasoned reflection, and perhaps some consultation with rape victims and those who work with them. It may not, in the end, be the right answer, but it certainly aims, at least, to take a wide view of what justice is and what it means to do justice to all those involved. Thank you very much for listening to me this evening.